Peter Matheson has written 8 novels, a collection of short stories, and 19 works of nonfiction. He's one of the founders of the Paris Review, and in his spare time, he's developed a notable career as a naturalist and environmental activist. Busy as he has been, he has still managed to fit in a personal literary obsession. By his account, he has spent a third of his life telling the story of a mythic outlaw named Edgar Watson, one of the early settlers of the southwestern coast of Florida. Mr. Matheson's most recent book, Shadow Country, is a reworking of his 3 previous novels about Watson's life and violent death at the hands of his friends and neighbors. It's published by the Modern Library, and I'm very pleased that it brings Peter Matheson back to the show. Hello.
Hello.
So how did you first hear the story of Edgar Watson?
I was traveling up the west coast of Florida with my father. He was a big fisherman. And we were traveling up that wild Everglades coast, 10,000 Island is called. And he showed me the marine chart. And he said, up that river, Chatham River, there's a house. And it's the only house in the Everglades. And the owner was a man named Watson who was killed by his neighbors.
Now, did this take place, because you even provide us with a map, in Florida proper or on one of the islands, the 10,000 Islands?
No, the 10,000 Islands are part of Florida. They're part of the Everglades National Park now. But it's a big maze of mangrove islands and lost channels, and it's very difficult to find your way around. And people hide out there. At least they used to. Watson did. And But my dad didn't know any more about Watson than just those facts. And so it stuck in my brain. And years later, I started this novel. And I was going to work it in as a thread, but it took over. The story was so fascinating. And everything I'd read about him was false. All the accounts were all myth and legend. And I really looked into him and tracked him back to South Carolina and his wives and children, everything.
Well, since so little concrete information about him existed, why did it take 3 separate novels to tell his story?
Well, he had a very long and complicated story, and also I told it from 3 different points of view. I told it from the neighbors, the community's point of view, and then from his son, his favorite son, who really wanted to redeem his reputation. And so he looks into it, and that meanwhile the information is accumulating, which I didn't have myself when I began. My great source of information were the gravestones. That was the one information I could depend on. And the last part of it is told by Watson himself.
When did you realize that part of what you were doing here was examining how American myths are created?
When did I realize I was doing that?
Yeah. Was that fairly early in it?
I think so. I think when I discovered that almost everything written about him was false or mythic, then I realized, how does this happen? And, of course, the local people who knew better were partly responsible. They embellished the story for people who came, who showed up down there. They told people what they wanted to hear, which was this guy was a desperado. He killed Bell Starr out in Oklahoma. He did this and that, you know. And it's possible he did kill Bell Starr. He was the only one ever arrested for it. But I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Well, that preceded him when he arrived.
Yeah.
And that probably helped him to accomplish certain things because they already had an idea that he was a dangerous man.
Well, there's a guy who wrote a book called Hell on the Border. Great title, I wish I thought of it. Hell on the Border described the death of Bell Starr and the various people who were suspected.
Well, you have to tell people who Bell Starr is.
Bell Starr is an outlaw woman in Oklahoma. She allegedly was a consort of Jesse James.
Another man who is the subject of a lot of misinformation.
A lot of myth. And Bell herself was, too. So that's how that all happened. And then he was supposed to have been put in the Arkansas State Prison for horse theft, which is a far more serious crime than murder in those days, and shot in an escape attempt. But he didn't get shot. He escaped. And he got back to Florida, and that's where his career really took off.
What were the alleged reasons for his killing Bell Starr?
They had a dispute over a land lease. He was a great farmer, and he leased this land and whatever. Bella was not difficult to quarrel with. Everybody quarreled with her. And one of the people suspected in her death was her own son. So that was more or less natural. And Watson himself had a very, very hot temper, which is why He did kill a few people. He didn't kill anything like what was ascribed to him, but nonetheless, he was a dangerous guy. But he also was a very likable guy. I mean, in some ways, his wives liked him, his children liked him.
Well, you must have liked him to devote one-third of your life to his life and his legend. That's pretty remarkable tribute to a man about whom so little is really known.
I was getting to know him, and also I was making him up. You know, I had so little to go on that I made him up, and then I made him, by my lights, amusing. He's quite funny, and he's a very good storyteller. And I had to do that to live with him for 30 years. I had to share his obsession.
And I'm sure you connected with him on some levels.
I did.
As you say, he's a good storyteller, and he lives the life of an outsider. In some ways, that's what a writer does as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true.
And also, he was in a place that it really does strike me as, from your descriptions, as a unique, really magical place.
Some people, my wife, for example, cannot understand my liking for the Everglades. She hates it. And I think really people are split down the middle. It's not a great scenic place unless you really know it well. And there are lots of mosquitoes, lots of dangerous snakes and so forth. So, and the climate's not great.
So why have you revisited this? You wrote those three novels. You pretty much accomplished everything you'd set out to do.
I didn't. When I wrote it first, it was all one big book called Killing Mr. Watson. And I brought it into Random House, and it was an enormous book. It was too big. They thought we would do much better to split it into three. And that's what happened. But I wasn't satisfied with the result, and I wanted to put it back together again. I thought it would only take a year, but it took five or six.
And it is broken into three books within this one volume.
Is.
So
it
to
is.
Some degree, you're still following the old format. If readers of the original trilogy read this, will they pretty much recognize everything, or will they
see major changes?
They'll
recognize a lot, but there are characters who are brought forward who weren't before. There's a great deal of distillation. 400 pages were cut out of it, and so it's a very different book. It's much more intense. It goes much deeper. And I'm pleased to say that certain of the reviewers acknowledge that. They say this is a different book, and I'm pleased that's recognized.
Well, you've said that writing nonfiction is like building a cabinet, whereas writing fiction is like creating a sculpture. So there's a lot more shaping here.
Yes, absolutely.
The setting is as much a character as the people in it. What brought these people to settle in Southwest Florida? How did they make their livings?
Fishing and farming. These people down where he lived, a lot of them began as fugitives. They were fugitives from justice. They began really fugitives from the Civil War, deserters and people like that. And a lot of them were just looking for a living. There were a lot of poor people, and they were wandering around, you know, the frontiers. But very few people settled way, way down in there. That was a remote, truly remote place.
My guest is Peter Matheson, whose latest book is Shadow Country. On the cover it says, A New Rendering of the Watson Legend. It is published by Modern Library. Modern Library, which mostly reissues classic books, in a sense, because they had already published, they had issued the three Watson books you could do.
No, they hadn't. Actually, that was Random House, and Modern Library is a branch of Random House. So, yeah.
You begin the book with the scene of E.J. Watson's murder at the hands of his former friends and neighbors. Why did you begin with the end?
Well, I wanted to get the plot out of the way, and the plot was the least interesting thing to me. I wanted to know why. And also, there was one extraordinary circumstance. There was a man, and there was a black man in that crowd. Now, remember, this is 1910. This is the worst time of Jim Crow. Black people didn't have a chance, you know, anywhere. They could be shot anywhere.
The man's name is Henry Short.
Henry Short. And to have Henry in that crowd with raising a rifle to a white man was unheard of. So why was he there? He could only be there. He certainly didn't want to be there. He was there because they wanted him there. And the reason they wanted him by all repute was that he was the only man who could outshoot Watson. And they wanted Henry there. And apparently, I mean, the legend is that no other shot was needed. He shot first, and that was all. But the crowd panicked and just filled this guy with bullets, 33 bullets, plus buckshot. That's quite a throw. killing.
Race is a major theme in this, but yeah. Also not just involving blacks, but also Native Americans.
Absolutely.
Were Native Americans treated in the same way that the freed slaves were?
Not in Florida, because they had, eventually they were, of course, but in Florida they were a very strong war tribe under Osceola and all those other great Indian leaders. And they joined forces, by the way, with runaway slaves, and they intermarried, and a lot of the people there are, you know, demonstrate that. Black people, of course, in our South in those days were very much discriminated against, but they weren't. Out west, they did the same thing to the Indian people. So it doesn't particularly matter. Racism is, of course, racism.
Of course, this area was settled, in some cases, by fleeing Confederates who didn't even know the war had ended.
Right.
So they brought all of those attitudes as well.
Yeah.
But one of Watson's relatives, Selden Tilghman, was a Southerner who fought for the Confederacy but felt that slavery was wrong. And
there are quite a few of them.
And Watson sees him as a kindred spirit.
He does and he doesn't. Watson goes along with the prevailing thing, but I think when the reader will see that Watson is really not a racist. He treats black people as real people, and Indians too. So one, that cannot be laid against him. And Selden Tilghman, of course, is tarred and feathered for his views. Because he was overt. He was an activist, you know, against slavery, all that, which was a mortal sin in his day in Edgefield County, South Carolina, which was very, very, very retrograde.
Watson, as a child, had experienced the loss of a slave who had nurtured him, who had been was killed by a cruel overseer. Is that all true?
No, that episode.
When I read this, I wonder, how much of this is Peter Matheson and how much of this is history?
Well, I'll tell you what I found. In the archives of Edgefield, South Carolina, I found that one of Watson's uncles or great uncles on his plantation, a slave had been killed by the overseer. And that is true. And that was not uncommon. Runaway slaves are often tracked down and shot. So, and this guy was Watson's really only friend. He was, which is maybe why he wasn't a racist, but he lived a very lonely and hard life during the Civil War. His father was away at war and so forth.
The first book has been compared to Faulkner's Absalom, in terms of its multiple narrators and historical questions. Was Faulkner an influence?
I certainly read a great deal of Faulkner when I was in college. I haven't read it much in recent years. I really don't think the two books are alike. What was his name in Absalom?
It's been a long time for me to
you read it too. But he isn't really fleshed out. He is kind of a mythic figure back in the distance someplace. Watson is nothing if not flesh and blood, and you know everything about it.
I guess it's because you have 12 narrators trying to tell us who this person is. I guess they could have said Rashomon as well, although multiple Rashomon. Oh,
they have. Yeah.
Whatever else E.J. Watson was, he's a man of vision and a hard worker, and he manages to tame a small piece of an incredibly difficult landscape. Was he respected for that?
Yes, he was. I think everybody agreed he was a terrific worker and very innovative, and they all tried to copy him. He had the best cane sugar plantation on the West Coast. It was a very well-known.
He came from a. He was well born, whereas
yes, well, he was well born, but his father blew the whole fortune. His father was the real bad influence on him. His name was Elijah Watson, and they called him Ring Eye Lige because in a bar fight, some guy got him down with a knife and cut a whole big red circle around his eye. So he was known as Ring Eye Lige, and he was the beginning of that family's disgrace. And he beat up his wife and kids, and they had to flee to Florida. That's how he got to Florida.
At one point, Watson was a bounty hunter. Did he do that because he needed the money?
We assume so. I leave that kind of vague. He needs the money very badly to get started in Florida, and he takes out a guy who was a killer in northern Florida. And we assume he had a lawless period there.
Now, how would you describe E.J. Watson today? A land developer?
Oh, he'd be an entrepreneur. Watson was a great friend, and he actually was. He's a great friend of Napoleon Broward of Broward County, Florida. And I think he really saw that he was going to be the guy that developed the west coast of Florida, like Miami and Palm Beach in the east. That was all going on. And he had this wild west coast, and he had a big control on it.
So can we blame hanging chads on E.J. Watson, too?
We can.
You say you learned a lot about obsession from having lived in the mind of E.J. Watson for 30 years. How much does a man who spends 30 years on a single story need to learn about obsession?
I was learning about myself, too. I think all novelists do that. You're going deeper and deeper into your own nature. And also, remember, I was doing a lot of nonfiction all through this period on American Indian things, on environment, on travel to Africa, Antarctica, and so forth. So when I say 30 years, it was 30 years on this novel, which was my primary work. Yeah.
At one point in the novel, Watson says that Americans love a desperado, not the scurvy villain with a scar, but the suave rascal of style and courtly manner. So is that a fundamental American characteristic, that we love the successful villains, the robber barons and captains of industry, as long as they remain successful?
I think so. I think those guys because they're doing a tight wire act. When is justice going to catch up with them? This is a suspense. A guy who's just kind of beat up with an eye patch and, you know, pocked skin and everything, and in rags, he's already shot. He's defeated, and so it's not much of a story.
So Watson's justification is that his business practices are just the American way.
Yeah, and also he took great pains from very early on to make sure he was in good standing with the businessmen, storekeepers, everybody like that. And they stood up for him and saved his bacon a few times.
Yeah. Sugarcane production is difficult even today.
Yeah.
So
it is, except for the sugarcane planters in Florida. They get enormous subsidies from the government, and they always have. They've got a real racket going in Florida, and they're very, very poor with their employees. They have bad labor practices. And in fact, not many years ago, one of the big companies down there was taken to court for slavery. They actually enslaved their workers, didn't pay them anything.
What were Watson's relations with the people who worked for him?
For the cane planters? I think, as I can argue it, Watson's cane was what began the whole Florida sugarcane industry. After he died, a couple of years after he was killed in 1910, a couple of local guys took a barge load of his cuttings from his plantation up the Caloosahatchee River, right up into central Florida, Okeechobee. And we think that's the seed cane at Moorhaven, Florida, that got the whole thing started. It would have been about 1915, probably.
You aren't afraid of addressing large ideas and themes, and that has become rarer and rarer in contemporary American fiction. Why do you think that is? I mean, there are still a handful, perhaps.
I think there are a handful. Don DeLillo, for example.
Norman Rush, another one.
Yeah, there are a few people who do it. I think people just aren't reading very much, and the publishers don't encourage big books, and the critics don't either. I mean, my book, this book is nearly 900 pages. I mean, you can see why a critic might be daunted. But writers, I think if you're serious, you can't worry about that. You have to do it the way it feels right. You just have to do it.
You deal with another one of your real interests, of the destruction of the environment. What were plume hunters?
Plume hunters were people who hunted the egrets. There's several of the egrets or herons. Herons and egrets are the same. But the egrets especially had these plumes during breeding season. They would develop these plumes on their neck and back. Absolutely beautiful plumes. And for a long while, for 20 or 30 years, every woman who had a hat had to have a egret plume on there. And abroad, too, in France, too. So it was an enormous industry, and they say that the egret plumes, which weigh almost nothing, but they were worth more than their weight in gold. And so people killed. They would kill for a good egret area for hunting and so forth. But that's who they were, the plumers.
And your description of the rookery after the plume hunter plunders it is devastating. It's really painful to read. So are you satisfied with this version? Are you finally ready to move on? What are you going to do with your spare time now that you don't have Watson to think about anymore?
Well, I'm doing a kind of a strange memoir which may never be published. I'm a Zen I'm a Zen teacher too, and we train people. We go into the shelters on the streets. We live with homeless people sometimes for a few days, and just to see what we're doing. Homeless people with AIDS but we also use Auschwitz as a training center, and we go for a week as an immersion in that, and we do meditation on the selection platforms and do services at the crematoriums and so forth. It's wonderful. It's wonderful training. It really wakens people up in an extraordinary way. And I did a memoir about two retreats in Auschwitz. And I don't think it will probably ever see the light, but I need to finish it.
I suspect that anything you write will be published as long as you complete it. Peter Matheson has written 8 novels, including A Play in the Fields of the Lord, which was nominated for the National Book Award, Far Tortuga, also a collection of short stories, and books on the environment. This is Shadow Country, and it is published by Modern Library. Thank you so much for being with us again.